You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week, joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt, and we have in the studio with us Jill Nephew, founder and director of Inquire.io, a public benefit corporation with web-based tools dedicated to providing people with environments and experiences that increase self-efficacy, that strive to remain neutral and unbiased, and that exclude limiting interpretations arrived at by comparisons with groups or individuals.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. Musical selections on today's program are from a CD called G.I. Gurdjieff, Sacred Hymns, performed by Keith Jarrett on piano. This track is entitled Meditation.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt, director of Tayu Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Great to be here this last Saturday in August.
This week on the show, Rob and I speak in the studio with Jill Nephew, founder and director of Inquire.io, a public benefit corporation with web-based tools dedicated to providing people with environments and experiences that increase self-efficacy, that strive to remain neutral and unbiased, and that exclude limiting interpretations arrived at by comparisons with groups or individuals. Jill is passionate about hacking social interactions so that every voice is heard, every life imagined into, and everybody spirited, young and old. Her work is deeply informed by the actual wisdom part of wisdom traditions and highly constrained by the latest research and scientific understanding of human social dynamics and cognitive evolution. She brings to her work a 30-year meditation practice, extensive training in physics and scientific modeling, and a career in developing complex software systems and models to tackle some of the world's hardest problems. She is also working on a soon-to-be-published book, The Race Against Insanity, Principles of Natural Intelligence. So, Jill Nephew, welcome back to The Mystical Positivist.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So we'll get jump right into the topic today. Mm-hmm. And by way of introduction here to our audience, Stuart and I have had the chance to read a book chapter that you've provided us with. This is not a chapter in the book Stuart just mentioned, The Race Against Insanity. Rather, it is a book chapter intended for publication in another volume, a single chapter in another volume that sort of summarizes much of the argument, as I understand it, mm-hmm. of The Race Against Insanity, right?
Yeah, it's a subset that has to do with kind of the global problems of Global Suffering and Problems of Impending Collapse. So it's a little bit more of the collective content of the book. The other part of the book is really more individual, like what's an individual psyche, like a person with themselves. So it's kind of both dimensions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the part we'll start with then, though, is the part from this paper, which is entitled mm-hmm. Preventing Catastrophic Suffering and Global Collapse Through Restoring and Amplifying Natural Intelligence. So maybe you could get started by telling us about natural intelligence versus other forms of intelligence, which is part of the paper, of course.
Right. So part of the whole point of doing this exercise to write a book that, or sorry, a chapter that sounds as audacious on intelligence is to come up with some definitions. The thing that I realized reading about intelligence is that there's just a lot floating around, and if you just use the word intelligence, people mean a lot of different things from it. This is a kind of an operational definition. Is that better? Okay. Natural intelligence, the way I'm using it, it shares a root among many people studying intelligence when you are attempting to, this kind of comes from AI historically, when you're attempting artificial intelligence, which originally was tasked kind of this idea of to build a model to understand how we're intelligent. So you'd say, let me build a model, just like we build a lot of models, and let me validate the model. And if the thing tends to do what we do, then we can kind of say we understand something about intelligence. And it's a wide arena they are trying to test, and it kind of split at one point between maybe what we're familiar with as artificial intelligence, kind of a machine idea or HAL, versus artificial creatures or the intelligence it takes to be an animal embedded in an environment that makes decisions for its own survival. What kind of intelligence do you need to actually just exist in an environment? And that kind of intelligence is what is kind of split off as natural intelligence. And as the years have gone by, that kind of intelligence, which we kind of take for granted because we don't necessarily, you know, we aren't in the habit of thinking single-celled organisms are brilliant, they can't play chess, we can, you know, we've kind of been focused on human intelligence. But as the years have gone by, the people trying to model intelligence have kind of found this, that the natural intelligence is much more sophisticated, much more difficult to wrap your head around and even build a model of and get it to do something that nature does.
So to summarize in one aspect of this, what you're saying is that there's a form of intelligence, or that's the label we're using for it, mm-hmm. there's a way of being in the world, a form of intelligence that humans share with other creatures, and that form of his intelligence is distinct from the sort of analytical reasoning faculties that, in the West at least, human beings have kind of celebrated as the epitome of our distinction from other creatures. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think this is a. I'm trying to scope how much I go into these. This is all very large topics, but in terms of measuring intelligence, coming back to that definition, a lot of what the early researchers were trying to examine as intelligent behavior was really limited towards kind of a behaviorist view of, like, did you choose the right answer? Did you optimally exploit something? It's very much kind of this idea of putting a deciding thing into a system and seeing how well it could exploit its system versus testing how well it could understand, maybe navigate, or live in a equilibrium with a system. So, ideas around how we measure, like games are an example, for instance, like that's kind of an environment that's really static where we place ourselves, and then we would have a measure just about any game of
right.
You know, it's a meeting of the minds.
Kind and there's a static configuration, and we manipulate that configuration, and our efficacy at manipulating the configuration determines whether we win or not.
Right, and then we have some way to compare outcomes, and then that's a pretty easy way to say your job is to beat the other guy's outcome, and then we'll just call that intelligence. So it's been a really convenient, easy way to measure it. In some ways, that kind of sets up a little bit of a bias that's more how we think about it than as we were saying before, this idea that it takes tremendous amount of intelligence to just come into the universe knowing nothing and not die.
So let me...
Got it.
Right. So I want to focus in on natural intelligence a little bit more to get a better sense of how... Just to understand how you're using the term. Because in one sense, often with intelligence... I haven't studied the subject deeply, but my impression is that there's a kind of intentionality associated with it. So if I'm intelligent in a conventional way, which typically conventional is analytic intelligence, I determine by act of will that I'm going to solve a problem and then proceed through some algorithm and solve the problem. And my
right.
my skill at that determines, quote-unquote, how intelligent I am.
Yeah.
In natural
can we just hold on for a second there? Because algorithm is a term that a lot of people aren't going to understand. Can we just define that? What is that?
Here,
what does
ahead.
That mean? I don't have a definition for it, but you are using the term, so I'd like you to just make it clear what that algorithm means.
I mean a recipe of steps or a procedure mm-hmm. by which one proceeds through a problem.
So an example of that would be the sort of learning how to multiply when you're in third grade or something like that. So there's a series mm-hmm. of steps that you undertake in order to solve the problem of how to multiply 14 by 22.
Right, and then conventionally computer programs are considered to be, a program might contain algorithms which are specific recipes for solving problems.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I guess like in the largest sense, I mean, without deep diving into how abstract this conversation can get once we start getting into the paper, but in a more general sense, you could almost think of natural intelligence. It's not as easy to define a decider, free will, intention, action, cause and effect, winning metrics, measures. What you know, I'm kind of thinking back to one of the classic. I guess it's Zen. You'll probably be able to correct me in a heartbeat. But the story about the we'll see. You know, when the farmer's son, the horse runs off and comes back with the horse. Oh, that must be great. Well, we'll see. You know, this idea that we can continually, everyone wants to jump to this kind of measure of like, that's great, that's bad, that's great, that's bad.
We should tell that story for the listeners.
Okay.
So the story is about the Zen master who, has a son and a farm and a horse, to plow his fields, and that's how he survives. One day the horse runs off, and so he doesn't have any animal to plow the field. So the villagers come up and are commiserating, saying, oh, this is terrible. What are you going to do? This is a really horrible event. I really feel bad for you. And he said, maybe, we'll see. And so they all go off. And the next morning, this lone horse comes running back to the fields, but it's followed by a bunch of wild horses. And the wild horses all sort of are able to be captured and put to work. And so suddenly the farmer has an abundance of horses. And all the villagers come back and they're all clapping and say, hey, this is marvelous. This is really great. What a wonderful event. And he looks and says, well, maybe. We'll see. And then a few days later, the son is trying to tame one of the new wild horses that they've come into, and the horse bucks, he's thrown off, and he breaks a leg. And, so he has to be done up in a splint. He can't work. Now the farmer doesn't have his son to work the fields, and all the villagers saying, oh, what a tragedy. What are you going to do? This is terrible. And he says, maybe, we'll see. And then, the next week the emperor comes through because the emperor has another regional war going on, and the army is drafting all the able-bodied young men of the village, and so they can't take the farmer's son because he's still recovering from a broken leg, and so he's the only one who is spared being drafted into the army. So the story, basically, the we'll see story, is that the farmer is not given, as you put it, to making an immediate conclusion about an apparent set of facts. but is holding a more holistic view that lots of things are possible.
Right, and he's also, you know, there's this kind of lack of containerizing, you know, having obtained or you know, having the horses, having escaped an outcome. And it's, everything's very non-dynamic, very static, these symbols of advancement or retreat, of how many horses do you have and so on. Yeah, so so coming back to your kind of inquiry into intention and intelligence, that, yeah, I think that that's also been kind of a hallmark of, and some of the confusion around, which I don't know if we'll go into it, but the artificial intelligence ideas of what that means today. The idea that if you, your job is to intend, then kind of your job is to decide something and decide it well by something you could measure and say this decided better or worse than something else. And this is how we build technology to decide that we'd call intelligent. When you think about natural intelligence, how you'd measure intelligence isn't so much how much you decide things, it's how much you can make sense of things.
Yeah, and I think the reason I'm asking the question is, when I read through your paper, one distinction that wasn't clear to me was that there's a... I can understand the distinction between natural intelligence in the way that you just described it and analytic intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
But when we try to attribute natural intelligence to natural systems, I have a... That's where this question of intentionality comes in. Because it's one thing for... a human being to, through use of mental faculties, to hold a non-categorical perception of the world and to be open to process and things like that, and to have a holistic, relational, or process-oriented view of what's happening versus someone who has a very static, category-oriented view and is reacting to the perceptions of events falling into categories. On a human level, that makes sense. On a animal level, what we call natural intelligence there seems to be a byproduct of long-term processes, natural processes, biological processes that adapt organisms or individuals in those environments to necessarily maintaining a kind of equilibrium status, because those that didn't simply died out. And so, for instance, there are examples in nature of systems where unchecked by competitors or predators, animals have exhausted the resources that are available to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have desertification, or you have you know, systems that sort of collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that natural systems are romantically, you know, somehow superior to human systems in that sense, because I don't think that there's any foresight in those natural systems. And foresight's a word that you bring into your
right.
I see that those systems are simply well tuned. Typically when there's a good balance of positive and negative factors to keep things in balance.
Well, you know, this is definitely outside my range of expertise, but I'm going to attempt to give you a counter argument, because you do catch me a little off guard bringing a deep philosophical question onto the radio. So, yeah, why not? Okay, so one case I'm aware of that, and again, this is outside my immediate domain of expertise, but I do reference it in the work, is slime mold. More recently, has been shown that it can respond to periodic light, which doesn't like being shined on it. And then what it appears to do, and no one knows exactly how, but it learns quickly how to model that. I should give it some background on what slime mold is. Slime mold starts out as a colony of amoebas, and then or can exist as just a colony of independent amoebas. These are single-celled organisms. And then under certain conditions, it comes together, and it either works in unison to form a body that acts as one. It can even cell differentiate and turn into a sporulating kind of fungus, or it can work as this kind of creepy crawly thing where it dissolves its cell wall and just becomes kind of a sea of nuclei and protoplasm. It's the latter I'm talking about. And in that system, that's the one where they are able to show a kind of intelligence where it's planned to Tokyo, under the right constraints, planned to Tokyo subway system very similarly to how the engineers did, which was a cute paper, but that it also could predict, anticipate conditions, learn conditions that were harmful to it, which were these periodic light flashes. So it has a kind of memory effect. And so I think the idea isn't a romantic altruism, even though that was one of the references was that insects, which are considered altruistic, an explanation is that they are somehow aware of the fact that they're in a system where multiple others will try to exploit the same resources, and so they should be in equilibrium with that, or else they will be catastrophic. But more the idea that they have a way of modeling dynamic feedback with their environment, so that it's not a clear differentiator between them and their environment. They get the feedback, and they make sense out of it, and they learn from it. So that's as far as the romanticism kind of goes, but it is saying that if you're cut off from some sort of feedback, that's where you are more likely to do whatever, you know, the desertification effect.
But in a natural system, the feedback may sometimes come in the form of predation or something like
that. Right, exactly. Like that. There's a check, yeah. So it's it's the ability to maintain a dynamic equilibrium, and we seem to be very good at kind of cutting ourselves off from various forms of feedback we need, that we don't actually get the signal. We don't see that our air quality is getting worse. We don't feel it in our lungs. We don't see that the oceans are piling up with plastic because we won't notice the lack of oxygen in 5,000 years today. We don't have the feedbacks with our environment so we can feel that this isn't going to work. We've got all these kind of bubbles around us that are going to result in, you know, some sort of collapse or another if we don't start to respond to the feedback we don't directly sense. So that is what I'm saying, is a restoration of those kind of feedbacks and a faith that, and I'm just going to call it a faith, I mean it's a science-based faith, but that we have the same machinery that everything else does, that when you give those feedbacks to our amazing, brilliant brains, that we make the right decisions, and that's what I'm calling foresight. It's the slime mold's using foresight when it's saying, oh, every hour this light flash is coming, I'm going to adjust so they don't, you know, whatever they don't like about light doesn't, you know, they do something. I don't know what it is, but
yeah, I mean, it's this is interesting because again, with a slime mold, you know, there's a condition that's immediately experienced, and that condition is uncomfortable, and so that provides a feedback from the environment,
right.
and the slime mold immediately adapts in a holistic way to that,
right?
Which is an example of the kind of ability to respond to feedback. To me, what's interesting about the human situation is that the feedback for the species is not immediate.
Right.
In fact, if anything, what you're trying to adapt, or what it seems to me that you're trying to advocate for, is the possibility that cognitions or perceptions can function in the same way as feedback has functioned in holistic systems.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, which is that it appears that, you know, if you wanted to argue something kind of wildly differentiates us from other creatures, it's that we, and I think this is, I don't make a strong point because I'm not clear animals don't do this, but I think other people would argue that animals don't do this. But our use of language allows us to assemble simulations. It's seamless when we use language to bring things into our imagination, like we're doing right now. We're broadcasting language around, and presumably people are listening to bring things into their imagination. And how we do that kind of seamlessly with our senses means that we're just kind of designed to do this, to be able to communicate these scenarios to each other, paints pictures to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? Because language is also the tool by which we instantiate categories that become the warp and weft of analytic thinking.
Yeah, and I think that's really, and actually, that's one thing I got very fascinated with. We haven't really talked about this too much, but this paper and this book kind of came about as a side effect of trying to understand language in the system I was building. Well, that is the Inquire system we mentioned. And in those tools, they're interactive and language-based, and I just got very interested in how to build, as I stated in the mission statement you read, how to build a neutral system. On what basis is language neutral, and what was kind of emerging from neutrality? And what was super fascinating to me, and I feel like is just really underappreciated. Every time I say this, I'm just kind of in shock that this is true. But if you know, there's a acknowledged at least multiple million words in our, you know, English vocabulary in circulation, and then if you start putting together words as like phrases, like that cute black dog down the street, that cute black dog down the street, you know, now you've got just literally infinitely many ways we can symbolically label things. We can label stuff all over the place.
Right.
And yet, when we're communicating to each other, you know, somewhere between 85 to 95, depending if it's more colloquial, percent of our verbal communication is only the first 800 words, which are largely just kind of routing stuff around. It is painting this dynamic arrangement of things. The way I try to describe it is like, it's like we're spinning this glass, this beautiful glass structures, and we can go on and on and on and talk in these open-ended way without a single symbol, without a single labeling single thing, and then just kind of put that one thing in, that remaining 5 or 15%, and just paint the whole picture. So these are like pronouns.
Can you give an example of what you mean by that?
Oh, shit happens. Sorry. Maybe I should have said that like that.
Right.
I think the biggest, the one that cracks me up the most is... it is what it is. There's a classic, you know, what are you really saying there? If we just slow down my speaking, we will see probably that most words I'm using are very common. And so they're connectors, they imply direction, they basically are constraints that relate to everything I'm talking about, so you can paint a picture.
So they're relational, as opposed to either descriptive or whatever.
They don't label the things, they arrange the things. And
right.
They arrange the things dynamically. And there's some really beautiful work on this, just showing that we kind of can't escape it. So many metaphors are physical, and that it seems like it doesn't just arrange things arbitrarily. It arranges things in a way that is like our physical environment. So there's actually like this intimacy. No matter how abstract we're talking, we're still tied to this physically embodied kind of situated reality. We situate concepts. We, using language, are always situating things
right.
physically somehow. So that's really interesting.
Through metaphor, as I understand what you're saying, in many cases.
I'm saying metaphor is a very nice example that if you listen to how metaphors work or start listening for metaphors of physical world, you start
right.
hearing them everywhere.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? Or, you know, I'm talking around the point or get to the point. You know, everything kind of... Mm-hmm. You know, hanging by a string, dangling, everything's kind of becomes physical.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of take it for granted. It's the water we're swimming in. So back to your point of that we get caught though in the other, in, you know, explosively complex number of words that are describing this stuff. And if we start to think in frameworks of this stuff and arranging these millions of words of stuff, and forget about how they're arranged, but just think about how they relate to each other. This is, we're starting to get into the more abstract ideas in the paper that this is kind of a problem for the way we think.
You mean it's a, if we try to encompass in our minds the myriad of words and descriptions for lots of different phenomena and lose sight of the relational kind of words, which is a much more simpler kind of structure, that we can get lost in the complexity. Is that what you mean?
I guess at this point, I probably have to just jump into brain science a bit.
Okay.
So the idea is that the way
another
these
physical metaphor. Jump into brain science.
Right? I mean, if you start tagging them, that's all we'll be doing. Yeah. So if
before we jump into this, let me just quickly say that you're listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. And this week on the show, Rob and I are speaking in the studio with Jill Nephew, founder and director of Inquire.io, a public benefit corporation with web-based tools dedicated to providing people with environments and experiences that increase self-efficacy, that strive to remain neutral and unbiased, and that exclude limiting interpretations arrived at by comparisons with groups or individuals. Great. So let's jump into brain science.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not a brain scientist, so I feel kind of like I'm misleading to say, but let me step back and say, I'm not anything, and that's part of the I'm an engineer, and I'm trying to build something, and I've studied a lot of things. So
right, but you have studied a lot of this literature. You've talked to a lot of people in these spaces.
Yeah.
So you get to speak.
I guess I haven't figured out what my voice is going to be yet with this, but yeah. Okay. Let me speak about what other people have said in the context of this conversation. So the idea is that you know, we see it in language that we aren't just representing static things. We actually are representing dynamic force space things. And we see it in the real world, and we see it with the idea of feedbacks, and we see it with the fact that our brain is a very fluid system, and we see it in the fact that when we hold things statically in short-term memory, it seems like they go away in a few seconds. They kind of just, we have to constantly be refreshed, and we can't hold that many. And so all this kind of points at a physical intuition, if you're trying to figure out what this thing does, our brain, that it's very good at fluid simulation. It's very good at process. It's very good at dynamic simulation. And so what happens is when we ask it to do this purely static labeling, symbolic, analytic type of thinking, it's almost like just forcing a hell-bent chihuahua to hold still or something. You know, it doesn't want to do it. It doesn't want to hold still, and it can only hold a few things simultaneously. And so it becomes this kind of painful, non-native way to think. So we aren't very powerful. I mean, this is probably pretty well known by most of the people in the audience that we're not that good at analytic thinking. That's why we invented computers, because they're very good at holding onto static symbolic information. And really, you know, in terms of artificial intelligence in the form of computing, you know, the calculators beat us for 60 years. We don't really have to worry about AlphaGo, you know.
Right, but I mean, the kind of analytic thinking you're talking about also describes the ways in which people tend to reify or make real conceptual categories that, from an objective point of view, don't necessarily have any sort of reality. I mean, right now, I mean, during a political season, you see that absolutely, you know, and if anyone's on Facebook, you can just watch your Facebook feed, and you'll see these, whether it's left or right, there'll be these projections onto other with a category.
Yeah.
And that category is reified as though it actually represents something, when in fact, at best, it's a statistical representation, and at worst, it doesn't actually have any solidity. It's just a bucket that becomes something that's reacted to.
Yeah, I think so. This is on the drive over. I actually identified this as something I really want to dive into further. I didn't know it existed. Philosophy is interesting. You don't know things exist as entire fields until someone tells you about them, and then you can go search for them and find them. But
it's
in the
not
paper,
just philosophy, by the way.
It's true. So there's an idea of could you build an entire logic based on negative information instead of positive information? So a lot of analytic thinking we're familiar with, which works. You know, I'm not negating the power of logic, but it works on absolute truth statements, and there's very few things are absolutely true, which we can get into later. But most stuff that we assert as truth statements are just one of these labelings, and they are just a projection. And so you can, you know, if you allow in a logical argument a broadening of the context to say, look, you know, the reason that this sounds like a contradiction here is because you've taken these two projections and erased all the information that would be nuanced that would show how they can coexist. So there's like a lack of broadening that. So really, in terms of what I'm talking about in the paper, is that there are things that are global, absolutely true, that we can speak to. it appears, and are things that we accidentally do that with. And when we accidentally do it, we get in all kinds of trouble. And not least of which is kind of this like incompleteness of argument, because you can get into all kinds of paradoxes, and that, you know, beyond the scope of what I could really explain to a radio audience, and maybe to even to myself completely. There's a variety of paradoxes around that any static symbolic system that's arranged as a set of truth statements, you know, is incomplete or paradoxical. It has a bunch of myriad problems that people have revealed, and we kind of just ignore that and carry on. So what it says to me, and I kind of talk about this in the paper and at length in the book, of course, is that there's a natural complementarity between using logic and rationality with things that can be considered absolutely true, embedded in a dynamic system. So there's a cooperation there. It's not an either or. And I think it's the either or that's really tripped us up for a long time, of thinking that it has to be all analytic or all whatever, touchy-feely or set-based or something else.
I mean, part of what I'm getting from this that's interesting is the arguments that have been made about the complementary functionality in brain processing. I mean, in its most, I think, naive form, it's left and right brain thinking, but I think the arguments have become a little more subtle, that there is a analytic kind of reductive processing mode, and there is a holistic, intuitive kind of systemic processing mode.
Right.
Both exist. However, if you look at modern Western society in particular, you'll see a dominance of expression and a dominance of discourse associated with the analytic reductive thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, it lends itself to measuring, it lends itself to teaching. It's, you know, it's definable. You can compare people across it as a measure, and it's not native in its purest form, and it's hard, like we talked about, it's hard to hold a lot of it in your mind, and so it becomes, you know, perhaps a useful exercise to learn how to exercise it. I mean, this is kind of beyond the scope of its utility. It's hard to say, because it's been so lopsided. If we ever got back to balance, we might have a better idea of, you know, if we ever got the problem where it's like, gosh, no one has enough Western philosophy and analytic intelligence, so we see the problem. But, you know, I'd only be speculating now that it does help it obviously helps to live within a Western culture, because you need that kind of executive control. You have to be able to think within those constraint systems and navigate them. So it definitely is life training. But beyond that, I don't know. I'd be curious to see, like, you know, how much you can't work around, you know, if you lived in a non-Western culture, how much you couldn't just work around everything without going through this formal process.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, together, both modes can be complementary.
Yeah.
And useful in their contexts. But it seems to me that the argument that you're making in your paper and in your book is that the dominance of the analytic mode, you know, however we call it, whether we call it, you know, analytic intelligence and native intelligence, or you know, holistic versus deductive thinking, it's the lack of holistic thinking and the lack of support for that you see as a explaining why we're as a society, as a global society, we're dysfunctional as far as foresight is concerned.
Yeah, but one thing I point out that I think people have made that argument before, and I am trying to make it a slightly different way that I think is more productive. And so the argument in the hypothesis of the paper is that let's put aside the idea that we want to think a particular way or we're trained to think a particular way. Let's think about how much do we automatically think a certain way given the nature of the information that's given to us. So if I give you just a static set of phone numbers to memorize, you're not going to, if you make up a pattern in there, if you see something deep and meaningful, it's kind of considered like psychotic. You know, it's like you have to think, what can you do with this other than think analytically with like a string of random numbers? I mean, what else are you going to do with seven digits of random numbers other than think analytically?
Well, in fact, the a lot of memory techniques for learning those numbers is to see a pattern.
Well, there's that.
So
okay,
that you can remember it.
Right. So you can cheat if your task is to memorize a lot of numbers. Yeah, that is actually another great example of using a real intelligence, which is that if you arrange them spatially into like a magic castle and associate them with objects in a room so they become a visualized, embedded, relativistic thing. So you basically create a meaningful framework for them when there wasn't one, then you can remember them, which makes sense. You know, so if we think about memory representation as being a mirror of this, which is, again, I don't want to get into the weeds of that just yet, but there's a lot of parallels just with the only thing that makes sense for memory is that it also kind of looks like this. So, So the idea is that what we're in trouble about is that we don't really understand data information representation, and we're accidentally thinking that we're actually distilling some really valuable information when we get it into this static form. Maybe it's statistics, or maybe it's a really great conceptual model, and we say, just throw away everything else. Let's keep it simple. I just want the good stuff, and let me just work with this. And it might be a model, and so that's what's circulating around, is people are losing the richer natural intelligence, and they're operating on systems that they can only be analytic against, and that's what's killing foresight. So it's not, I mean, you could also argue that we're overtrained, and that's might be a factor as well. It might be why we look for it, and, you know, there's a little bit of, I think, disproportionate respect for the systems, of course, you know, because they're familiar, they're Western, and they're hard to think about. We also respect people that can think their way through a really complex conceptual analytic argument, but more the point is that there's a lot more control than we maybe realize if we actually just looked at it from an information science, information technology, data representation point of view, and actually start to look through that lens. We might actually have a giant available leverage point to start cleaning up how we represent information, so we just naturally restore foresight.
So let's ground this in a practical example.
Okay. Right?
Because you mentioned a number of examples in your paper, and I think in your book you'll expand those. So, for instance, we could start with climate change, since that's actually a field that you were involved in academically for a period of time, right?
Yeah, right.
So how can you kind of walk through in somewhat layman terms how the current, you know, maybe the social relationship to climate change and some of the problems with climate change science, you know, could be revamped with a different informatic representation system so that we could make better decisions?
Well, I mean, let me just preface that by saying one of the points you make in the in this paper we're referencing here that you wrote is precisely the disconnect that so many people have with being able to relate in a useful way to some of the information that's been accumulating in, by the climate scientists using these analytical methods. So I just want to frame it in this way. So in other words, how do we change the way we relate to with people and teach people how to relate to information,
right,
in such a way that we can at least ameliorate, if not mostly eliminate, this this clear issue that we have in current American society.
Yeah, that's actually a really awesome, really meaty example, and not coincidentally, a lot of the fuel behind this paper and this project. I did study in graduate school climate science, and that was in mid-2000s, 2005-ish, I guess. And it was right around the time when Al Gore came out with Inconvenient Truth. And studying it was a real wake-up call. I remember even just the when I was interviewing scripts to go to school there, I talked to one professor, and he says, you know, most people think we have like this network around the planet, and we're like monitoring Earth, and we know what's going on, and there's like this network that actually knows what's going on Earth. He's like, there's no such thing. We don't have, no one funds it, no one cares, there's no initiative. There should be a Peace Corps. This is our life support system, and there's no way to get just even on the budget the idea that we should maybe be tracking what's going on with our life support system. And I remember being kind of taken aback by that. And then the following 2 years of study, it may seem melodramatic, but almost every day I had said about my time at Scripps, I was in someone's arms crying or someone's in my arms crying because of all the things we were learning that could go horribly wrong. Because when you study just a system as a scientist, you know, you find a little bit that you can actually manage to wrangle and measure and publish something you know about. It's very, very hard in complex systems. But the rest of the time, you're studying it with your natural intelligence. I mean, scientists are using natural intelligence. That's another thing that's very interesting. A lot of people think scientists are cold and rational, and they're trying to be impartial when all their life's work goes down the toilet. But aside from that, you know, they're using their natural intelligence when they're trying to say something constructive about something they're studying. So to have the opportunity to become a climate scientist meant I was given the opportunity to take a lot of time out and just observe what was happening on the Earth. And seeing as I was understanding these systems, everyone was worried in ways that weren't published. And so that was one thing that I thought was tragic.
Tragic that...
That there's no voice.
Right.
There's no voice. So, you know, you talk to a paleoclimatologist, and they might... One fellow, I remember, told me that, you know, we know that there's this incredible variability of the Indian monsoon, and we can't say anything about it. But it just flips, and then it's gone. And there's no rain for decades in the paleo history. And that could happen any time now. We don't know how it's going to happen. All kinds of things could happen. We don't know what's going to happen.
Just as a side, that an observation like that is an observation that the system's so complicated, we don't really know what's going to happen.
Exactly. So
we don't know what effect we're having.
That's right.
And of course, that's the same argument that's used by climate change deniers to say, well, we don't know what effect we're having, so how do you know it's that we're responsible?
Right. And so I think that what's missing then, when I went out and tried to talk about this, is that what you know when you study the Earth system, like an ecosystem, like a living body, is that everything is designed to keep it in equilibrium. It needs to stay a certain way. If we raise our temperature a certain amount, we're toast. If we have a little bit of lead, we're dead. I mean, there's so many things that kill us. It's like you can't even count how many things will kill us. The Earth's the same way. You shut down any of those systems. You shut down the circulation of the oceans. You shut down where the rain falls. So many ways there's so much intricacy in this entire system that creates our life support system, not cockroaches and not, you know, bacteria and, you know, our life support system, that if you just start wrenching it around, knowing that it has these long response times, you're just seeing this complete, what we're actually doing is absolutely willy-nilly. It's just willy-nilly. It's like, you know, just slow down, everybody. Everyone should be terrified of, like, just calm down. Do you really need to do this right now? Do you really need to be mining and digging and burning more? Do we have to do this? You know, and it's kind of, it's just a complete giant blind spot that's still there. So when I was at Scripps, I remember people were concerned about plastic falling to the seafloor. You know, the fact that we have oxygen depends on 6 inches of mud at the bottom of the sea. And there's now gobs of plastic sitting on top of that mud. And the last paper I read about it said, well, we do know that everything that decomposes, everything we need to release the nutrients to create oxygen on the planet, is probably full of plastic. And we do know when it's full of plastic, it dies. And no one's had the chance to study it. We already did it, you know. And there's not going to be a paper saying we're turning off the circulation of the ocean. The big warning sign came with the ozone layer, where that was considered an understood system. That was a dead science. It was such a simple system. There's not much up there. There's a few chemical constituents and no turbulence, nothing like down here. Not much gets up there. And they said, well, you know, there's nothing to study. So we created this hole with spray can propellant. And if we happened to use a bromide-based instead of chloride-based propellant, we would have knocked out the hole ozone layer, which is crazy, like the entire thing. And that's our shield from radiation in space. So at when I was at Scripps, again, this is 10 years old, I remember one professor had an array of, you know, thousands of different chemical compounds just wanting to know what's in our air, and she thought she could kind of grab it all. She says, just fill up the whole thing. We don't even know what we're breathing, you know. We know it's a ton of free radicals. We're looking at cancer rates go up. We're not going to know, you know. We're not going to know until it's too late. And so, in general, to give people an intuitive sense of that, of like, to get them to really feel that, my God, like, the best thing I could do on the planet is just try not to consume much of anything, you know. Like, it's, like, if that's all you do, that's great, you know. That it's not as complicated of, you know, of recycling programs and optimizing taxing systems. And I mean, we could do all this, but it's like we have this behaviorist model that we have to like coerce everybody into doing these incremental changes, and they're not doing it. They're just going to do whatever they feel like doing. Mm-hmm. So what can we get them to feel? And when I went out and tried to educate people on climate science 10 years ago, I actually gave up. I gave a number of talks taking this tact of what don't we know, what's the problem here, how can we think about it different. And with only 1 hour of stage time, by the end of the talk, if I was lucky, I, you know, asked for the first question, and it's always like, well, so is global warming happening or not? And I just realized this is a deeper problem. People can't think like this. They aren't trained to think like this. I can't do this in an hour. We all need to change how we think about this. And I think that's what this paper that introduces my paper, the Ehrlich paper and the Ross paper, are talking about with foresight intelligence, is that how do we get people to really, it's not just about information, it's a relationship to information.
It's like trying to anticipate possible consequences, right, at a holistic level.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it's to... It's to understand, have a lot more humility and sensed vulnerability that we're actually part of a system. I really don't think people sense how much they're alive because they're embedded in a life support system anymore. And understanding that feedback, their actions feedback into a life support system. They live because of this life support system. And if we can't get everyone to get that, that's their kind of the number one imperative right now. Because we're really, really running out of time. No one's reacting, and mm-hmm. things are getting bad. And, you know, it is a kind of big deal. It is the biggest deal to get people to start to sense into that every way we can. So, but I think that coming back to the individual project, I think that that kind of understanding, when you change your thinking, to be kind of more aligned towards the process-based, dynamic-based, multidimensional, complex-based thinking, I think you rapidly start to take this kind of information in. I think that you can get a sense for the different kinds of information. I remain hopeful that it's not even a problem of delivering this giant ball of information 10 years ago, like everyone needs to become a climate scientist. It's more, I think, changing this relationship to information so that you resist the bombardment of oversimplification and these silver bullet ideas and these polarizing arguments are extremely complicated and draining.
Got it. So, so it seems to me then that what you're talking about is creating a way for people to learn Stuart was using the word holistic. You've mm-hmm. you used other words to create a sense of expansiveness that is sort of intuitively present.
Yeah, I don't know if I call it expansiveness in a sense, but I think of it more like lack of a container, lack of being contained. It can still be contextually very specific. It's not like
It doesn't. Yeah. I mean, expansiveness doesn't have to
contextualized. It's that in each moment you understand what you're doing in relation to the big picture of your life. Mm-hmm. Every minute of your day, you don't break that connection.
So you're seeing yourself in relationship to the whole system.
Yeah.
And you're seeing the actions that you as an individual take you as a collection of individuals take in relationship to the impact it has on the totality of the system.
Yeah, and I think, and it's beyond seeing it in the analytic sense. It's also about, I think what comes out of it is you start to feel it. And I think that the beauty of this is that I think that's what a lot of people I know are really craving. You know, one definition of meaning is connection. Just it's the connectedness of information. That's how we define meaning of a word, is how is it connected to a context. So if we feel like our lives don't have meaning, that's how we should be feeling if we don't feel like our lives are embedded in a context. If we feel disconnected from the world around us, we would naturally feel a sense of meaninglessness. And that sense of meaninglessness correlates to just about every negative health effect,
right.
Period. And it's very large in this country. It's very large worldwide. It's exceptionally large here. So there's a little bit of hope that this is not forcing something down people's throats. It's actually just something that will feel correct and natural, almost like correcting a misunderstanding.
So then the challenge is how to formulate a program that will actually be realizable, and one that people both don't find threatening, but
right.
also are attracted to and open to.
Right. Well, that's the nice thing, is that, you know, more and more, it's interesting. This big picture thinking historically has been in the realm of spirituality or morality, speaking of which. And when you actually just start getting into kind of the brass tacks of brain science and sticking people in machines and looking at what happens, and you start to realize that that just the process of broadening and thinking in a consistent whole context, just that, without having to call it anything, without having to call it spiritual or moral, you get this emergence of spiritual or moral, in a sense. So this kind of broadening of questions, or this broadening perspective, I should say, what you did call it broadening before, and I'm saying it's kind of the broadening is what allows the situating in the greater context that this is can be controlled through how we ask questions, actually. It's kind of one of the most powerful things we can do is just simply reformulate a question into an open form and a certain kind of form that invites process.
Well, why don't you give us an example in the climate change arena, for example?
We have
in the which?
Yeah, no, we have just a minute or two before we have to take a break. So
should I wait?
You can do a quick question.
I'll do a quick one. So the classic confabulation scenario where we lie to ourselves and we get really confused is when I ask you why you did something. So anything like why did you just bite your bottom lip, Stuart? You probably have no idea, and if you try to make up, you probably will want to make up something, and it'll most certainly be wrong, especially if your brain's split in half, you can prove it was wrong. So that's pretty classic, like a bad question to ask people. And a good question would be big picture how questions. So, you know, how does the radio station work? Or what is that big black tower for? What does that button do? And so kind of these open-ended questions allow just switching out of this kind of analytic small-level cause and effect into more descriptive, open-ended. And so that's not only more truthful, but it's also just naturally broadening. So there might be language forms I could just do this.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that with some more examples after the break. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick, The Mystical Positivist. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. This week on the show, Rob and I speak in the studio with Jill Nephew, founder and director of Enquire.io, a public benefit corporation with web-based tools dedicated to providing people with environments and experiences that increase self-efficacy, that strive to remain neutral and unbiased, and that exclude limiting interpretations arrived at by comparisons with groups or individuals.
We'll return to our show after a short musical break. Musical selections on today's program are from a CD called G.I. Gurdjieff Sacred Hymns, performed by Keith Jarrett on piano. This track is entitled Hymn from a Great Temple.